Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories for this very special interview with Richard Dutcher, the father of Mormon cinema. I'm John DeLynn. Please bear with me while I make four short but very important announcements with regard to this interview. First, these interviews are not only available in audio format, they're also available in high-definition video with footage from Richard's actual movies at youtube.com/mormonstories. Please check them out if you can. They're quite amazing. Historical, even. Second, Richard is in critical need of support for his current film project called Triptych, so please visit the website kickstarter.com during the month of October 2010 to donate. Kickstarter is a site created to help fund creative endeavors, but it requires that the funding target be completely raised before any funds change hands. Each project is given a particular number of days to reach its funding goals. In this case, it's 30 days, so time is of the essence. To learn more about the Triptych project, listen to this full interview or visit the site and type in Triptych. Triptych is spelled T-R-I-P-T-Y-C-H and or Richard Dutcher. That's kickstarter.com, K-I-C-K-starter.com. We will also have a link to Richard's Triptych fundraising page at richarddutcher.com. For those of you who do not own Richard Dutcher's movies, such as God's Army, Brigham City, or States of Grace, please consider supporting Richard's incredible filmmaking by buying the DVDs today at richarddutcher.com. That's D-U-T-C-H-E-R. These movies are fantastic, and you will enjoy these Mormon Stories interviews so much more if you've actually seen the movies. I can't recommend these movies highly enough. Finally, if you'd like to make a gift or investment to help Richard with one of his much larger film projects, including his much-discussed Joseph Smith movie, please contact him through richarddutcher.com or via Facebook. Again, the last name is spelled D-U-T-C-H-E-R. Let's do our part to help him make that Joseph Smith movie. It's his birthright. Thanks again for listening, and now on with the show. Take it away, Dan Witherspoon.
Well, Richard, I'd love to just move on, and let's just take you through the rest of your filmography and tell some stories about each one and the different things and what each one means to you and sort of where it sits in your heart today, where, you know, what was on your mind then and all those different things. And,
okay, great.
And I'll bring us right up to the present with the movie Evil Angel that's currently at different festivals and things right now and right. Seeking distribution.
Right.
So we'll do that. But before we dive in anymore, I want to make sure that our listeners know again how to order your films. So they can go to MainStreetMovieCo.com or RichardDutcher.com and order any of God's Army, Brigham City, and States of Grace, which are the two we're about to talk about. Richard is filming a new project right now called Triptych. And he is raising money, and there's a place that you can donate and support this at kickstarter.com. And if you search Richard Dutcher and Triptych, you can learn a little bit more and get a better feel for it. And then I'm sure that through contacting you some way, you'd be willing to talk to somebody who was thinking of supporting you.
Oh, absolutely.
In Triptych. So. Yeah. Great. And then finally, for the big roller, so those who say Richard Dutcher is an artist that I really want to believe in to the tune of a bunch of dollars, definitely Richard will take your call and your connection. So just through Main Street MainStreetMovieCo.com again, or find him at Main Street Movie Company through Facebook.
Right.
So good. Great. All right. Let's next in your, how do you say that word? Ouvre?
Over.
I don't know.
Not French.
It's one of those in my head. I see it. I pronounce it a million different ways in my head. But your filmography, your body of work, your oeuvre, whatever it is, Brigham City was next.
Right.
So tell us about the inception, the idea for it. I know it was filmed in Mapleton, Utah,
right.
where you live. So give us.
Yeah, let me jump back just a bit. I, after we finished speaking, there was a, and it has to do with Brigham City, but we were talking about my conversation with Charles Metten when I was at Brigham Young University and how, you know, I said, I could be the next Orson Welles, and you're, you know, trying to talk me into being a makeup or costume person. And he said, you're not Orson Welles. But after Brigham City, I got a note from Charles Metten, and it was really wonderful where he said, he goes, I remember back when we talked about it, and you told me you were going to be the next Frank Capra, which is funny to me because it was, that was very complimentary, but I wanted to write back and say, no, I said I might be the next Orson Welles, and you wouldn't recognize it. But it was kind of a funny story, but he was very sweet, and he was very, he loved the movie and thought I'd really accomplished a lot, so that was really sweet. But I would have loved to have been able to you know, even now it's like go back and say, here's all the things you could do to make this film program better. But
yeah.
But anyway.
And now again, as you talk about Brigham City and the rest, let's just kind of remind both of ourselves. Let's kind of assume no familiarity.
Right.
From our listening audience.
Okay. Well, Brigham City came about because it was right after the success of God's Army, which was in the spring of 2000. And so I wanted to just follow that up immediately. I was so tired of films taking 5 years apiece. And so I just thought, well, there's some momentum. And obviously this works now, so I should be able to raise some money to get another film made. And so I had written the film Falling. As I was raising money for God's Army, before I actually shot God's Army, so I had written this film, and I loved it, and I just knew I had to make it. And so that was the first thing that it was ready to go, you know. So as soon as God's Army was out there, and it was, and by that time, Excel Entertainment had come in, and they were helping to get the film out to the rest of the country so I could step away from it a bit. And so I thought, well, now I'm going to bring out Falling, and I'm going to go make it. And so I was actually on my way to Los Angeles to do the casting for Falling, and I was driving out of Mapleton in the morning. I was going to make the drive to Los Angeles, and as I was passing the gazebo at the center of Mapleton. It's a very small town. It's not commercialized at all, but there's a nice white gazebo there, and I drove by, and as I drove by, the morning sun was hitting it just really pretty, and I just thought, well, that's so cinematic. What, you know, I could make a movie, something about with that gazebo in it. And so as I was driving, you'll notice a certain theme here. It's like driving's a great time for me to come up with and develop ideas. But as I was driving back to Los Angeles, I started to play around with this idea, and I thought, okay, and the movie started off first being, I thought, you know, I saw a couple maybe dancing on the gazebo, and so I thought, well, maybe it's a kind of a small town romance with, you know, middle-aged romance kind of movie. But by the time I got to California, there was a body under the gazebo, and it was about a serial killer in a small Mormon town. And I was so excited about the film. I kept playing with the idea and playing with the idea, and I was piecing it together, and I really liked the way it was going. And it wasn't until I got to the idea of the climax of the film that I got so excited that I had to pull over. So and by the climax, I mean the story climax, when the sheriff is confronting the killer, and the way that I designed this sequence where the killer would be putting together a handgun as the sheriff was explaining his guilt and about to bring him in. And so I thought the tension in that was going to be so fantastic. And I was so excited that I pulled over. By that time I was at Victorville, California. So I pulled over, went to the Motel 6, and I was very used to, you know, all my years of raising money for little movies, Motel 6 was all I could ever afford. So I pull over at the Motel 6, and I sit down, I just start writing like crazy, and I'm so excited, and I'm in the shower, and I'm taking notes, and then I realize what the end of the, it was just something I was developing. I didn't know if it was really a movie yet, but as soon as I came up with the very final scene of the film, which was that night, I knew that it was the movie, and so...
And you knew it had to be next?
And I knew when I woke up in the morning, it was like, okay, I've got to do this next. It's like Falling, I was worried, it's like, okay, and it was basically the same film then as it is now, maybe a little darker now, or when I did make it. But I thought, okay, this could be so jarring for the audience that, again, a very sincere film, and it was something that I didn't have any, you know, problems with. But I knew that it would be R-rated. I knew it would be so
different from God's Army
that it might just, you know, make my audience's heads explode,
which it eventually did in some cases.
So I thought, but Brigham City, maybe this is the kind of thing that I should follow up with. And so I got back in the car, was finishing the drive into L.A., calling my casting director, saying, okay, we're not doing Falling now. We're doing a movie called Brigham City. And so when I got there, we actually started casting a different film, even though all I'd done is like one day of writing. So we start casting, and then I come back to Utah and start raising money as I'm writing the script and casting and finding locations. It was all just so... so quick. It was the fastest script I think I, well, not the fastest I've ever written, but the fastest from conception to shooting. In fact, I figured it out one time, and I was from conception to the movie actually being shown in an audience, at a premiere to an audience, was like 9 months, 10 months. So it was like a gestation period of a child. And that's the fastest that I've ever.
And it's for many your best. I mean,
some people like that.
It's very well received.
So. A lot of people tell me it's their favorite film, and I would love to be able to have that, the kind of resources where I could do that. You know, just every year, just bam, 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 instead of these long periods of development.
The fundraising, yeah.
And but anyway, so that's kind of the background of the story, and.
And so for those who haven't seen it, you mentioned it's a serial killer in a small Mormon town. You're the main character. Again, you've hired yourself to act just to save money.
Yeah. Actually, that's exactly why I did it. I was, as we were casting the film, and I had a certain budget, you know, so I was trying to do it within a certain budget. And I knew that I was going to play the deputy part in the film. I thought that was the fun, that would be the fun part that I really wanted to play. And I wanted William Hurt to play the sheriff. It was like William Hurt would be perfect, you know?
He would.
And he would have been so much better than I was. But I also knew I wanted Wilford Brimley, and I was actually trying to get Andy Griffith first, because I thought Andy Griffith would have been fantastic, and it would have been playing with this Mayberry thing as well as the other stuff.
Yeah, the tagline of this is what a serpent loves. Every garden attracts a serpent, or
nothing.
Nothing attracts a serpent like
Nothing attracts a serpent like paradise.
Yeah, yeah.
And anyway, I couldn't get Andy Griffith, but I could get Wilford Brimley. But by the time I paid him pretty well, and by the time everything was worked out, and I had committed to hire Brimley, and I had no money, I couldn't afford William Hurt, and so it was like.
You talked to him or talked to his people at least at this point to get a ballpark?
Just the beginning feelers, but it was just kind of like,
Yeah, he probably fields those all the time.
Exactly, and it was just like so much more, there was no way. There was just no way that I was going to be able to afford it. And so at that point, it was like, well, I guess I could play the sheriff. I could bring Matthew Brown in from God's Army to play the deputy. And it would work,
and it did work. But for those who haven't seen it, your character, who's the sheriff of this small town, is also a Mormon bishop,
right?
Which brings up some really fascinating tensions.
Right. And so it was really a lot of fun to make. It was the first time that I'd had financing before I started shooting the movie, so I knew that I could actually finish filming, and so that was. Wonderful, and I was shooting, in my own hometown, so I literally, could crawl out of bed and be on the set in 5 minutes, and it was just a real pleasure to make. Like every film, though, it had its challenges, the production challenges, but I'm very happy with the film, the way it turned out, and
it's a murder mystery, but it again is a spiritual film.
Right. Well, so, the murder mystery, that's the thing that a lot of people misunderstood, was I was making a spiritual drama. That's what the film was.
Right.
If it was a genre film, you'd say, well, it's a spiritual drama. But there is no genre called spiritual drama. So therefore, everybody just thought, oh, it's an... And so some critics especially went in with Agatha Christie expectations.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't that. It was like, marginally, it was a murder mystery, and I was playing a little bit, but I wasn't even taking the murder mystery part of it very seriously. I was just kind of playing. I probably should have taken it more seriously. It's not a genre that I get all that. I'm not a huge fan of murder mysteries. I am a fan of suspense films, so maybe I should have taken it more seriously, because to me, when people later were criticizing it, saying, well, it was a murder mystery, it's not, it's not the best. I was like, well, okay. It's also not a comedy. But maybe I played a little too much with some conventions of the genre, and I should have taken it. But still, I'm happy with the film.
But I agree with you. It is a spiritual story. I mean, it is the story of, sin and redemption and community healing, and just the different things that, you know, if somebody comes into your office and she's in your ward as the bishop, but you have to ask her, are you talking to me as the sheriff or are you talking to me as bishop? And all those different things were wonderful. And then you had the outside federal agent woman come in, and you were sort of her guide into
Mormonism,
how small town Mormon stuff works. And But I agree, it's a very powerful film.
The interesting thing about it, though, is there are certain things people told me later. The film did, ironically, it's been more white. It didn't do as well at the U.S. box office, at the Utah box office, as God's Army did. But it's been more widely seen than God's Army because of, you know, it's been, I think, because of the serial killer story hook, then we've been able to sell it, you know, in a lot of foreign territories. And so it's actually the film of mine that's been the most widely seen to date, even though it wasn't as profitable as the others.
Let's just deal with it. How profitable or non-profitable was it?
Yeah, it wasn't profitable. We spent way too much market, because we were kind of, we'd had the experience of having God's Army, and so we were expecting that it was going to do as well as that, if not better. I let Excel Entertainment, who were doing the theatrical distribution on the film, I let them make some decisions that I felt like I would trust them. You know, I was like, okay, you guys went through the process with God's Army. I'm going to trust you. Let's go with it. And so some really poor decisions were made.
As far as not emphasizing that it was a spiritual film.
No. It was more just logistics of distribution, where we, instead of, you know, God's Army, I opened on 13 screens, and then it eventually, you know, went out till it was nationwide. But we allowed it to grow. And on this, instead, we just took the top 50, I think it was 50, 55 theaters where God's Army had played, and we opened on the same day in all 50 of those theaters. So it was kind of like, not a huge nationwide release, but it was basically a nationwide release. And with a lot of money being poured into the, you know, LDS communities for advertising, and the film just didn't, you know, it didn't perform big that first weekend, and so
it's hard to keep it in the theater
theaters. So in retrospect, we should have done it the exact same way as we did God's Army, and just allow it to grow as large as it would grow, and instead of blowing everything in the front. And also, I made a really poor decision afterwards, which was I knew that we had a really poor distribution decision, because I knew that we could, through Excel Entertainment and through the LDS world, we had a certain distribution, you know, as far as the DVDs and videos would go. But I wanted it to expand beyond that. You know, I was like, I wanted things to... I thought the film was approachable. You know, non-Mormons might not embrace the film, but it was at least approachable and interesting. And so there was a company in Los Angeles that wanted to do the DVD distribution, and they could get it into, you know, so much wider distribution. And that's what they told me they would do. And so I made this decision thinking that it would actually expand the market. But what turned out is they were not the most ethical company. And basically they were looking, you know, they basically just did what Excel Entertainment would have done by marketing to the Mormon community, but so much more poorly, that they were just looking for the easy hanging fruit. And so they did not push the film into the wider marketplace. All they basically did was send out ads to all the video stores, so that, you know, some places in Wisconsin or wherever that wouldn't normally carry the film carried it. But that's something that we would have done through Excel anyway. So basically, they didn't do anything that we couldn't have done. They just did it a lot worse. And then they weren't, you know, very good about actually paying the money that we had learned. So that was a big lesson for me. And unfortunately, Brigham City really took the hit on some lessons, you know, in the marketplace, both on the theatrical side and on the DVD side. And in fact, it got so bad that with this particular video, this DVD company, that they had just bungled it so completely for so long that I think it was 5 years afterwards, even though I was supposed to be tied into this contract for quite a long time, I just...
You bought back the rights.
Reclaimed the rights and pushed it, you know, illegally, so that I could get the movie back, so that I could at least make the film available in the LDS market. So it was really a tragic situation, because I think the film would have been received so much better, and even in the LDS community and in the Utah community, if they had been able to find the DVD and buy the DVD, and if it had been reasonably priced, it would have done a lot better. So,
and as far as your investors go, they didn't get fully paid back.
No.
They certainly got some of their money back. Were they happy with the film as a product?
There was one investor in particular, a smaller investor, but who content-wise were very unhappy with the content. They were very nice personally, but were very clear that they didn't approve of the content of the film. And then all the other investors were very happy with the film itself, but of course not happy with the financial return, which I don't blame them, you know, because it just didn't work. So that was, and actually Larry Miller was the main investor on that film, and that was his first real experience with a film. So, but unfortunately, I couldn't bring back a wheelbarrow full of money like I did with God's Army, just because of some really some poor choices that, in retrospect, you know, we just should have made other decisions. But
well, let's, before we leave Brigham City to move on to God's Army 2, States of Grace, some favorite moments from Brigham City, some things you're most proud of, any stories from the set?
Yeah, in fact, that's one thing I was mentioning before I got off track. But the scene, for instance, the scene where the sheriff and the FBI agent are outside on the porch of an old house, and he's talking and about naivete and spirituality and worldliness and all this stuff. That's one of those things that just wouldn't make it into a mainstream release, that kind of conversation, and yet that's... And I was conscious of that. In fact, when it went foreign, a lot of countries wanted to trim out a lot of this stuff. And to me, that was the... You know, it's like, no, that's got to stay. You know, it's got to be... This is the reason I made the film. And so even though people who were just wanting to get the murder story on, you know, just get on with the murder story, it's like, well, okay, but first you're going to have to, you know, I want these characters to, you know, to be real. I want them to tell their stories, you know. It's like, I don't want this to just happen to people. I want these to be people that have some depth and have something to, mm-hmm. and that are characters unlike other characters that you've already seen in movies. So that was the kind of scene that crept in. So for that reason, that was kind of one of my favorites. I love, the whole reason I made the movie, the last probably 15, 20 minutes of the movie is for me just thrilling. I love to watch it even now. I mean, the murder climax when you find out who the killer is and bringing him down, I love that scene. And then, of course, the scene afterwards with the sacrament meeting, which was the reason the movie was made, love it. You know, I just...
Yeah. I mean, it's like I look at that and I say, wow, this guy really rolled the dice. Because if that scene in sacrament meeting didn't work, and with the ordinance of the sacrament, as a moment of reconciliation and healing, and with all the strangeness of waiting until the bishop partakes before the... I mean, if that didn't work, that would have been a real problem. But
yeah.
You rolled the dice.
Yeah, yeah. So that's very gratifying to me. The one thing that, again, there's nothing that I really don't like about it. You know, little tiny things, like little tiny shots that I would probably redo or do a little differently. But other than that, the criticisms that I've received on the film have been really interesting. A lot of people have a real issue with the fact that when things get really ugly and the young girl is abducted, that the sheriff knows, I mean, he knows her, and... You know, he basically breaks the law and violates the Constitution and goes, you know, having the town members searching people's houses without warrants. Some people have become so upset by that, and it's like, and to me, I've never really understood that. It's like, that's what that character would do in this situation, because to him, his job's not important. All that's important is finding that girl. And it doesn't matter if he goes to jail, if it doesn't matter. So I find that interesting. I found, as we were making the film, this was some of the weirdness creeping in, where I had a crew member quit, a pretty prominent crew member quit because he thought it was a bad movie, you know, that it was going to reflect poorly on the church. He didn't want to be a part of it. He was in his stake high council. He didn't want to, you know, be associated with this film. So I just let him go because whatever. I had a guy quit because we weren't praying over the food at lunchtime. Mm. He was very offended that I was not asking there to be a prayer for the crew. You know, half of our crew was not Mormon or not active. And to me, that never even occurred to me. So there were some weirdnesses there, you know, where we were dealing with, you know, some people with sensitivities that I couldn't take the time to be sensitive to their sensitivities. I had to get my film made. And then, of course, the same things, you know. But I think by the time Brigham City came out, though, there was a lot of talk about the ordinance of the sacrament, but I think people were getting used to the fact that that's just what I was going to do. So, mm-hmm. In fact, I remember, it's kind of a little piece of my personality, but I remember people were giving me hell about certain things in God's Army, and I remember thinking, well, just wait till the next one. And
because that at that time you thought it was going to be falling.
It didn't matter what it was going to be. You didn't like that. Well, guess what? It's going to get worse. But yeah, so Brigham City, that, what else should we cover on that? It was,
You kind of hit what I was mostly interested in, but I, again, to the listeners and viewers of this,
One other thing you mentioned about casting myself. A lot of people are interested in that. One of the things that is interesting is, well, my first film, Girl Crazy, I acted in because I was free and I thought I could do a pretty good job. But being basically my first film and learning to where I learned how to make a film, but also being the lead actor in it, so I was directing and acting at the same time. So people have asked if that's difficult, and I say no, but that's really that's the way I've learned how to do it. So to me, it's just natural. So God's Army, it's not weird. But there was a moment where one of the things that was instrumental in me playing the part, besides the fact that we had no money, playing the part in Brigham City, was there was a scene in God's Army where the main character is having a spiritual experience where he's seeking some contact with the divine, you know, where he's kneeling to pray. It's Elder Allen, and things are kind of at a point in the film where he has to make a decision. Is he going to stay? Is he going to leave? Whatever. And so he's praying at night and trying to have some kind of an experience, trying to get a testimony or something. And I was shooting this film, and I wanted it to be a very quiet moment, and I wanted it to be a very real moment. I was trying to capture on film this moment of this connection with the divine, some spiritual experience where you actually feel like your heart and your soul is touching God. And it was incredibly difficult to get that. For one thing, it was interesting as a filmmaker. It was like I didn't have any reference to go look at other filmmakers' films and say, how did Scorsese do it? He's never done that scene. You know, nobody, Woody Allen's never done that scene. And so I had to do it myself, and which was fantastic. I loved filming something that nobody else had really filmed, at least what I was trying to film. But it was difficult to work, even though Matthew Brown, he's a very spiritual person and he's sensitive, but he had never really had that experience. And so as we were shooting it, the first we shot, gosh, I can't even remember, it was like 11 or 12 rolls of film, which is a lot of film, trying to get this moment, and he just wasn't getting it. And I was trying to explain what we were going after, wasn't getting it. It couldn't be a sentimental, it couldn't be it couldn't be sappy.
You couldn't have a light appear.
Right. It just had to be something internal, and it had to happen, and we had to capture it on film. And I thought, you know, after all this film that we'd shot, I finally thought, well, we've done everything we can do, so maybe it's there. And I've had that experience before where I didn't think it was there, but it turned out to be there. So shot the rest of the film, went into the editing room, and it just wasn't there. And I couldn't cut it together, and it wasn't there. So I had to go back about 6-8 weeks after filming and do it again. And again, we burned through a lot of film and tried a lot of different approaches, but finally got that moment. And I was like, oh, okay, great. Got it. And as opposed to Brigham City, where I knew what experience this bishop had to have, and it was a spiritual moment, and it was an emotional moment, and I just knew, as the writer, and as having had this kind of an experience, and having had the experience as a writer of creating the scene and kind of living that as a writer, you know, it's the same thing where we're shooting the production demands, you know, we're shooting in a church or a former church. We only have a certain amount of time. We've got to burn through this. And so I'm shooting all this stuff, and it's kind of like it's my turn to do this. So turn the cameras on me, and I was able to just, okay, bam, do it. Move on to something
else. So
you, else.
Know, you got to skip the whole thing of truly working with an actor to
exactly.
really convey all that. Yeah,
exactly. So,
yeah,
so that's one thing that when you're dealing with when you're making a film, when I'm making a film that's this personal, that's certainly a benefit. You know, because I didn't have, you know, I just burned right through that. I knew exactly what I wanted, and I was able to access it, concentrate. Bam, it's done. We moved on. Whereas I could have been there for 2 days trying to get that out of an actor who just didn't really know what I was after.
Yeah. And the same thing, I'm sure, when it came to Falling.
Exactly. Yeah, that was one of the reasons when we talk about Falling, but that was one of the things. It was like, again, I had very little money. I had to get this done, and there were actors who were better looking than me, who were better actors than me. But when you get to the crunch time and those particular scenes where that either make or break a film, I knew I could do them, and so I did them.
Yeah. But yeah, very interesting. Well, thank you. Brigham City, highly recommend.
Thanks.
Falling was on your mind next, or when did the idea of doing God's Army 2, States of Grace come in?
Well, honestly, the reason that I did States of Grace next was, I was supposed to be doing the Prophet next. I was supposed to be doing
Joseph Smith film next. Yeah.
And so there was a break between, so Brigham City came out in 2001 and States of Grace came out in 2005, and the reason there was that gap was because I was off trying to make the Joseph Smith film. While I was gone, of course, a bunch of other filmmakers came into the marketplace with their films. So the first two films were God's Army, then Brigham City, and then Mitch Davis came out with The Other Side of Heaven, then The Singles Word came out, and then there's a whole slew of other stuff. And I say stuff with generosity. And meanwhile, while this was happening, though, I was, you know, I shot Brigham City, it was out there, and then I was on making the Joseph Smith film. Because as I was doing the marketing part for Brigham City, I finally figured out how to tell the Joseph Smith story. It's something that I'd always wanted to do, but it's such a huge story. And it was so, and so I was always thinking about how do you approach it this way? And it couldn't be just some boring historical drama. And it couldn't be just something that only Mormons would like. And so I kept playing with, but when I finally cracked the nut, when I finally, it was a big puzzle, when I finally figured it out and it was like, oh, this is how you tell it, you know, just the narrative, the whole structure and the whole thrust of the story and how it would be told, how you could tell this massive story in a 2-hour period of time. When I finally figured it out, I was very excited, and we had the momentum, you know, Mormon cinema was off and running, and it was just, I felt like, if there's a time to do this, it's
going to mount my expedition to Everest. Here's
right.
the season.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And so that's exactly what I did. And so I was able to, the screenplay that I've been working on for a long time, but as I was finally able to put it into the shape that it needed to be in. And after all the, you know, the research was just, and it had been, you know, it's like from the time I recognized that this was a story I wanted to tell, which was probably when I was 14 years old, you know, when I knew I wanted to make a film, and I knew that this was a story that had never been told. And so I, from that time, you know, I'd always been, anything that I could find on Joseph Smith, I'd read about it, and I was trying to figure out how this story could happen. And literally, it was that long, and on my mission, a lot of bus rides as I was riding around Mexico, thinking, how do I tell this story? How could I tell this story? And then all the way up to that point, where it was after Brigham City, I finally figured it out, and so I jumped in. Everything that I had learned, and I continued to pull in everything else, and I had just what I thought was a killer screenplay, and went out and started raising money for it, you know. And the first little bit was easy, you know, because Larry Miller was now a friend, and, you know, he wasn't happy about Brigham City money-wise. He didn't, you know, the story was fine, but...
But he thought you were still worth investing in.
Yeah, yeah. At least, you know, a little bit. He wasn't going to put up the whole $15 million that I needed, but he was willing to contribute a little bit. And enough that we could really get going. And then I had the money coming in from God's Army, and so I was putting all of this money in. And I just went for... I went forward with such a feeling, feeling of mission and passion, and I knew it would work. And in the past, you know, I'd always taken things to the... It was literally the breaking point, always to the point where I was literally one day away from not being able to have food on the table for my family, or a film falling apart and something would happen to keep it going, which helped to, you know, increase my faith. And so I was a pretty faithful person. I wasn't, you know, daunted by much of anything. And And I knew, again, I knew I had the story. I knew it was a great story. I knew it would just do so incredibly well. And, but basically, yeah, that's basically, there's a whole story behind the unmaking of that, and it's going to be great extras on the DVD for when this film finally does get made. But the unmaking of The Prophet was quite a story. In fact, when I watched the documentary on Terry Gilliam's Lost in La Mancha, where it's basically the unmaking of his movie on Don Quixote. Mm-hmm. And it was so painful because I experienced so much of the same thing. But basically what happened with... I guess I'll be more specific here than I've ever
been.
Well,
I want to talk about The Prophet at some point. We can talk about it now, but I know that there are elements that playing with your spiritual journey yourself.
Let's talk
as much as you want right now, and we can revisit anything else.
No, we're kind of on this thread, so I'll talk more about the... We can later, when we're talking about the spiritual journey, we can hit that a bit. It's not as much as people think.
Yes, by that was one of the big questions. Yes,
but basically, what was happening with The Prophet was I was going out. I'd made a name for myself within the Mormon community, so I pretty much had access to talk to just about anybody that I could. A couple of things I did not realize were the one thing that I. You learn things as a producer. And one thing I tried that I thought was a smart move at the time was when I knew that I was making this film, I knew that Larry Miller was coming in with a little bit of the money. I knew that I had a little bit of money. I thought the best way to do this would be do a big, kind of a press conference, let everybody know this is what I'm doing because it's a huge project. There'd be a lot of interest in it. And I thought that interest would help propel the project forward. The momentum would continue to gain. Other investors would come in. We'd just get the thing made. It'd be simple. Mm-hmm. What I didn't understand was as soon as we did the press conference, the antagonism and animosity mm-hmm. was unleashed. It was absolutely amazing. There were other Mormon filmmakers who, for some reason, felt that it was their story and that I had, and so instantly. The animosity from just the film community. It was almost like every Mormon filmmaker had felt that he was called by God to make this movie, and that I was interrupting his divine calling by doing this. And my attitude at the time was, you guys have had, and a lot of these guys were older than me. And my attitude was, you guys have had 30 years to make this story, and you haven't done it, and you're not going to do it. And so I'm going to do it. So I jumped in and didn't care too much about that, but also. The anxieties about the film was huge, which I kind of underestimated. I didn't think it was from the general church membership. There was a lot of anxiety. The wealthy church membership, to whom I was going for the financing, a lot of anxiety. Church leadership, a lot of anxiety. And I think by this time I'd also gained a certain reputation as kind of being independent, and I was going to tell it the way that I saw it, and I think a lot of people were worried about that because they didn't know how I saw it. I would have thought, though, that the credentials that I had amassed by this time, if you didn't know that I was sincere.
You got two very sincere movies.
Yeah,
very open-hearted movies.
And I'd served a mission, at the time, I'd been everything in my wards except bishop probably by this point, and... I don't want to go into specifics because I want people to buy the DVD later. But it was like cloak and dagger nonsense, ridiculous stuff going on where there were, people, potential investors. I already knew that this was touchy, so I would make people sign a non-disclosure agreement before
I
would share
the script.
Yeah, if somebody said, I'm very interested in investing, I would say, great. You may see the script, but you must sign this non-disclosure agreement that you won't share it with anybody. You'll give it right back. You won't make copies. And it was crazy. People have those signatures meant nothing. I had people copying it, sending it to the First Presidency's office saying, should I invest in this? Read this. And I even had a particular, this was very, this in no way had anything to do with my eventual disaffection from the church, but there was even a particular apostle who was having, you know, was having people approach me as potential investors so that I would share all my documents and information so that they would then have access to them. And basically, whenever I would get an investor, I would lose an investor within a week. You know, the same, I would get one and then who would be gung-ho and here I'm going to give you the money. And then a week later, you know, they'd get the word that this was not something that the church wanted to have happen. So I went on for this again, I was used to this process of you hear no all the time. You keep trying to raise money, you keep doing it forever. What I didn't realize was that, you know, everybody was working, not everybody, but so many people and a couple of very powerful people were actively working against me. And the ironic thing is at the time, if Elder Ballard had called me on the phone and said, "Brother Dutcher, we appreciate what you're trying to do here, but this isn't the right time. Will you put this project on hold or will you not do it?" I absolutely would have said, "You bet." You know, that's the kind of Latter-day Saint that I was at the time. I would have said, "Really? Are you sure? Because I'd love to make it. It's going to be so good." And, you know, I would have tried to sell him on it. But if they had said, you know, "We don't want you to make it," I would have said, "Okay." And so the fact that there was all this backroom, ridiculous subterfuge going on was absolutely ridiculous. And it was quite offensive to me, actually. It was like I'd basically given my whole life to Mormonism and to this Mormon filmmaking. I'd served a mission. I'd never committed any sins that would keep me from becoming a bishop or whatever. And I was, as soon as I said I wanted to make a film about Joseph Smith, I was seen as a threat and as an outsider in some ways. And that's really weird. That was just absolutely weird. So basically that's what happened is, even though this stuff was going on, some of it I didn't know about until later, when other people came forward after I was basically bankrupt and said, "Well, just so you know, this is what was happening." Mm-hmm. It's like, "Oh, thanks. You know, somebody could have told me this at the time," because at the time I was just kept funneling money into it. I had it to the point where I was crewing up. I had locations in New York and Canada, and I was casting, and I'd gotten Val Kilmer on board to play Joseph Smith and F. Murray Abraham to play Governor Ford. And I'd completely cast this movie and it was ready to go. And literally got to the point where it was my last dime, whereas every time before I'd gotten to this point and somebody had come through for me. And, you know, it's like I was at the out on a limb and the limb had broken and something would always catch me. And this time I was out on the limb, the limb broke, and I just crashed, you know. And, I just looked around at I was left literally with... Everybody pulled out, so the only money that had gone into this was my own money. Yeah, so I was basically.
I know you still have storage units with some of the things that you had built, and I'm trying to remember. I've heard that from you.
No, it's like I say, we were literally just weeks away from starting to film.
Wow.
But this time it all just dried up, and every phone call I was just basically left out in the cold.
Yeah.
The other thing that pisses me off though about this is, again, the behavior of these people is, you know, they're playing with my family, they're playing with my livelihood, they're, you know, playing with me providing for my kids, and to allow that to happen, you know, to allow, instead of just coming to me and saying, "Brother Dutcher, let's not make this film right now," and allowing me to provide for, they let me actually get to the brink of bankruptcy, you know, and that just irritates the hell out of me.
Yeah, I mean, there's one story, I don't know how public you've been with it, and just tell me, I'm not going to talk about it at all, where it was 100% made clear to you that they had a script in their possession. You called the guy directly in the church headquarters, and he used every lawyerly language or whatever to deny it. Are you willing to share, or is that
going into? Yeah, why not? Boy, let's let out some of this stuff.
Stories audience, you're going to like me. Yeah, if I get this stuff out.
Yeah, let me think. I block these names out of my brain. Because...
And it's fine if you don't want to name a name, but you've told this story to me in a compelling way before.
So one of the, I'd gotten word that the script was in the First Presidency's office. And I even knew where it had come from and who had sent it, who had copied it, who had sent it.
One of these people who thought he had proprietary claim right. on the story. Yeah, I know who that is too.
Right, exactly. Somebody else who had written a Joseph Smith film and thought that, you know, and had wanted theirs made. And so, you know, was basically trying to, you know, just another person trying to shut it down. But I knew it was there, and I was angry at that point. I thought, well, come on, guys. Just if the First Presidency wants a copy of my script, just call me on the phone. You know, I will I'll send you whatever you want. Yeah, you can see every version of the script that I've ever written, you know. But to be going behind my back and getting other people to steal it, basically, and receiving stolen property, somebody who did steal it, then sending it to them and them receiving it, I was really irritated. And it just felt like, you know, behavior that was very unbecoming of a Christian institution. But anyway, I was irritated, so I called up. And it's the assistant of the First Presidency, and I knew the script was there. And so I call him up, and again, I'm a faithful member of the church. I'm not going to cause too much trouble, but I need to kind of, you know, get people to get this in perspective, you know. So I call him up on the phone, and I talk to his assistant, and she wants to know what I want. And I say, I'm Richard Dutcher. I'm making this film on the Joseph Smith story, and I know that you guys have recently come in possession of my screenplay. And this is copyrighted material. Those who are in possession of it have signed non-disclosure agreements that they're not supposed to share it with you. And I just want to let you know that if you want a legitimate copy of my script, I will send it to you, but that I think that, you know, I'm not happy knowing that you guys are in possession of one of the screenplays. She said, well, let me talk to Brother...
Starts with a W.
Brother W. And then she gets back on the phone. She, you know, is talking. I'm on hold for a little while. I get back on the phone saying, Brother W says that that we do not have a copy of your screenplay in the office, and so we hope that, you know, alleviates your concerns. And I said, well, you don't have a copy of it in your office, or it has never come through your office? Have you seen my screenplay? Again, puts me on hold, off, comes back. Brother W says that we do not have a copy in the office. And at this point, I was getting a little frustrated. I was like, look, this is ridiculous. It's like, just if you guys want to copy the script, just give it to me. You don't have to steal anything from me. Just and so I hung up kind of frustrated. But it was just, yeah, I was so frustrated. Because and it went back. I think there was even one more little element to that back and forth where the guy, there was, because I said, just can I talk to him? Because, you know, basically, I'm accusing you guys of taking my screenplay, and I think I should at least have a conversation with someone. And then just back on again, the same assistant saying, Brother W says that we don't have a copy of your screenplay in the office. It's just this ridiculous, lawyerly nonsense. So,
one more story that I'm aware of, and again, you can share or not. And this one, I don't know the people's names or something, but you told me about one particularly frustrating experience in fundraising was people who had, you know, really sincerely liked the script. They were ready to invest. They're so wealthy that even for them to fund the whole entire thing, it would have been less than 1% of their stock portfolio,
right,
or something like that. They pray about it. They have spiritual confirmations that they should do it. Do you want to finish the rest of that story if you're able to share it?
Yeah, well, that's just a nutty story.
But it just kind of shows that there is this interesting mentality out there.
Yeah. There was a particular wealthy gentleman that I was speaking with, and he did the whole experience. People, it gets a little weird sometimes with, which is one of the reasons I'm glad I'm not really doing this anymore, but with mixing business with religion. And, you know, I'd go and I'd pitch a business idea. And even though, you know, it's like, it's a good cause and something, I would never say, you know, I would never use language like, you know, the Lord wants you to do this or any nonsense like that, you know, but people would always say, we're going to pray about it. It's like, fine, great, pray about it. You know, that's your own thing. But this particular couple, yeah, we, you know, pitched them the idea. They prayed about it, and he said, "Yes, we've received a very strong confirmation that we're going to finance this film." And so, my stocks now are at this certain point, 27. I can't remember the particular numbers now. It's been so long, but it's like at 27. And as soon as the stocks go up to, you know, 28.5, then, you know, we'll do this.
Yeah, because that'll be enough of a movement that we don't even feel it.
Exactly, because basically I went back and I looked at, because I kind of knew their portfolio a little bit, and so I went back and I went, oh, when it jumps that much, then they've made well above what they need to invest in this. So I was like, well, okay, great. Well, however you guys want to do it, that's fine. You know, I'm just excited to be able to go make this movie. And then, of course, immediately after, you just watched as their stocks just started to chip, you know, just fall. And pretty soon, you know, they were like way under, and I knew it would never get back up. And they never did invest. They never, you know, never would do it. But it was interesting to me that yeah, I'd forgotten that story. That was
what was the whole stock market trending down at that moment?
Yeah.
It's not like for those out there that thinks God didn't want it made, so he's particular.
He
looked at their particular portfolio.
I see it more as a if there was a divine element, then it was punishment. It was him saying, "You greedy bastards."
That's right. Yeah. No. Anyway, wow. Well, you've told us a lot about the Joseph Smith movie. I'm going to push a little bit more. And can you share anything? I mean, there were questions that were sent in to the Mormon Stories website that wanted to know if you can, in any way, what was the approach to it and what subjects were you going to go into? Peepstones, polygamy, polyandry, Joseph and Emma. You know, I mean, how much are you willing to share as far as, you know, that nugget moment where you said, now I know exactly how to tell it in a compelling way without it being just a historical, you know.
Well, I don't want to talk about it too much because I am going to make this film.
Good. So that's their big question. Is this still down the road? Still your Everest that you're willing to mount more resources to eventually get it made?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if somebody came to me now and said, I'll put up the $15 million, you need to get this. I could make it cheaper. I'd $12 million, you know, at this point. I just when I get it made, but
www.richarddutcher.com.
No, if somebody came up and said, I want to see this movie made too, here's the money, I would be making it tomorrow.
Would you make it the same way as you would have back?
Hell no.
Okay.
But let me just say that I would learn from all of my previous mistakes, and if I was making this movie, nobody would know that I was making it. There's no way in the world I would open up that can of worms again. So I would just go off and make it and then, you know, just come back and spring it on them like I spring God's army on them, you know, and just say, here you go. It's done. Deal with it. No, I wouldn't make it the same, but it's not what you're thinking. And
it's
I don't want to
like
talk
the
about
story
specifically
would get negative, more
about
negative
because I do feel like I figured it out. I mean, and so I don't want to share that because somebody else could jump on it and do it.
Who does have a trust fund?
But I do feel like I found a way to basically tell the whole story, and I'm aware of different things. I mean, it's something. I was telling someone about it recently where they say you put it on the shelf. It's not really on the shelf. It's on my shelf, but it's become a tradition now. It's like every holiday season, like Christmas, when I've got that break, I seem to pull that out and go through it again and continue to sharpen and develop it. Even though the screenplay's, it's ready to shoot tomorrow, but I keep sharpening and changing it. So it's evolving in a certain way. But I'm also, this is a story, I'm going from the way that I see the story, the way that I see Joseph Smith, the way that I see the rise of Mormonism, and so that's what I'm telling. And I'm very aware of the fact that when I tell this story, there's going to be true believing Mormons that will hate it, and there's going to be a lot of anti-Mormons that are going to hate it because, you know, it's going to be just like everything else where the true believers are going to say that I, you know, is sacrilegious and I slandered him, and then the antis are going to be saying, you treated him too nicely, you did, but I, you know, I'm not making it for any audience. I'll be making it for myself, especially after all this time. Mm-hmm. I'll be telling the story the way I want to tell it. I agree. I've read a couple comments that people say, well, now that you're out of the church, you're in the perfect position to make it. And I agree with that because if I had made the film in 2001, 2002, like I had hoped, I definitely would have been more sensitive if one of the leaders had called and said, we got a hold of your script illegally, and there's this one part that we're uncomfortable with. I probably would have massaged it a bit and changed it to you know. And now I don't care who calls me on the phone. I'm going to make the story the way that I'm going to make it, and I frankly don't care so about the reactions.
Now that's a good right there. So the church leaders can't call you. What about your investors? I mean, do they ever demand script control, or is that just sort of, at least some input on things like that? Or how do you massage that relationship with somebody who says, there's strings attached to my money?
Well, to this point, I haven't had to deal with that because the people have trusted me, and it's just a situation where they like the films that I've made in the past, and so they're willing to just let me do. In fact, there's only been a couple of times when I've ever had to share a screenplay for the financing. I just say, this is the movie I'm going to make, give them the broad outlines, and, you know, they've known my work enough to just say, okay. It's just like, you know, if you don't know architecture, do you really need to see the blueprints? But in this case, yeah, I don't know. There are certain strings attached that I wouldn't make it. You know, if somebody came to me and said, I'll give you the $15 million, but you can't touch polygamy, then I'd say, well, I can't tell the Joseph Smith story without polygamy. You can't do it. You know, you can't do it with honesty, with integrity. or if somebody came and said, I'll give you $15 million, but you've got to make Joseph Smith look like the most, you know, deviant pervert, you know, then I'd say, no, I'm not going to do that either. So, you know, it's a give and take. If somebody came and said, you know, I've got the money, you're going to make I'll help you make the movie. But here's some of my take. I would certainly listen to whatever their point of view was. And if there was something that I thought was valuable that didn't destroy what I was already building, yeah, you bet. I'd love to incorporate stuff. But no, I would love to make the film. And it's going to be a great film. And I've always described to people, you know, they always think of the Joseph Smith film and they think of the crap that the church has done. And they think of these very polite, very, you know, it's kind of clean, it's polite, it's quiet, it's historical, it's boring.
And he's now just like a 21st century guy instead of this frontier, you know.
Incredibly charismatic, you know. This movie, when it does get made, is going to be, you know, it's going to be just fast-paced and exciting and challenging, and people are going to just be outraged and loving it at the same time. So it's going to be, I'm looking forward to making it. I just hope I'm not 80 years old by the time I get to make it, but that may be.
Okay, I'm going to let you escape any more talk about it right now.
Thank you.
But with the proviso that when we talk about your spiritual journey, I'll see if you'll at least part the curtain a little bit about your take on Joseph Smith.
Great.
As a prophet, as a man, or whatever, without totally giving away the heart of your movie. So
okay, perfect.
That's what I'll ask at that point. So, all right. So now we've learned that this was going to be next after Brigham City, and your hopes are dashed. Your family's basically bankrupt.
Yeah.
How did you pull yourself out of that situation, and where did God's Army Two States of Grace
by the end of that process, my wife and I had bought a little piece of land in Mapleton. We were going to build a house. But to keep the Joseph Smith project going, I had to, you know, mortgage the property. And then by that time, I was so heavily in debt, the only thing we could do was, like, sell the property. So basically, we're just starting off from scratch again. So, and by this time also, it was an interesting position because I had blown all my money on the Joseph Smith film. And then I turned back to the Mormon cinema movement and realize what was happening there, and watching it being just decimated, and really the idea to make States of Grace came simply from the idea that time's running out. I looked at it and I just saw it's like time's running out. The LDS, the Mormon cinema market is dying fast.
And again, we can talk about this more later, but it's dying because the quality of the films, in your opinion, were just shrinking the audience because they weren't good.
Yeah.
They weren't powerful.
It's not my opinion. I mean, it's my opinion, but it happens to be correct, which is the films were so bad that they were drove the audience away, that they killed the market.
And so even if a great movie came in, it would still struggle because people had already
been disappointed
too many times.
I believe right now somebody made a brilliant movie, a brilliant Mormon movie for a few hundred grand, put it in the theater, people still wouldn't go see it. That's how bad the reputation is. And it's going to take some time for it to heal, if it ever does. But no, that was the point where I was seeing it, where it was like, I didn't quite understand it until after I'd made States of Grace. But I could see, I kind of predicted what I thought was going to happen. In fact, the day after I came out of the singles ward, I think the first screening, on the first day of the screening ward, of the singles ward in Provo, I walked out of the theater and I just knew that it was, that the clock had begun. That the first nail was in the coffin and that it was going to end. And so I saw that thing happening. And actually, I did not endear myself to some of my other filmmakers because because I started to speak about it, because it was something that, and I try to put this in perspective for
now,
people.
You appeared in the film in The Singles Ward out of friendship with
yeah,
those.
I was trying to be supportive. Yeah. At that time, yeah. I was wanting to be supportive of anybody that wanted to jump in and do this. You know, I was like, anybody that wanted to participate in Mormon cinema. I was very idealistic at the time. I was opening up everything. I was telling people how to book movies into theaters. I was telling people where to go for money. I was just like an open book, and naively so, and I should not have done it. But again, I was so invested in Mormon cinema, and I thought, I still had this kind of cooperative mindset where, you know, we were going to do this together.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
a movement.
Everyone has spiritual stories to tell the way I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they only had caricature stories right. to tell. Yeah.
Right. And so I really wasn't prepared for what happened. I kind of thought, I was aware of what had happened in Mormon theater, you know, and Mormon music, and it kind of, and I should have seen it coming much more clearly than I did, but I started to figure it out. And I actually, you know, very in conversations, I was being very upfront with what I thought was happening. I said, we can't do this. The quality has to get better. The movies have to get better. They have to get deeper. They have to get smarter. They have to get more entertaining. Otherwise, it's going to die. And then when I saw what was happening, and the, you know, Singles Ward especially, it was so derivative and it was so poorly made and it was just awful. And I came out and I just knew that it was, and people were going, which I knew was going to backfire. But anyway, I kind of kept, except in private conversations, I kept encouraging people to make better films. And I really didn't cut loose on Singles Ward until, because I wanted it to succeed. Again, I wanted the films to succeed so that more films could be made, my films could be made. Mm-hmm. And so I waited until they had their whole theatrical run, and I waited until they released on DVD. And then after a couple weeks of their DVD release, when I knew they'd made a big chunk of money, that's when I finally said, okay, guys, the movie's crap, and you're going to kill what we've got here. And so, but again, immediately that's where I started to gain a certain reputation for being egotistical and blah 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 and arrogant, and it was like,
imagine that.
And
I mean, to me, just to be an independent filmmaker anyway, there have to be a certain amount of confidence in your own vision and in what you think. So, every one of those qualities, you can still say, well, that's a necessary quality in many ways to do what you've done.
Right.
To believe in yourself and your story and your vision enough to see it all the way to the end. That's a rare individual.
Right. Well, there's a difference between being self-confident and being arrogant, though. And I still think I was, and the sad part about it was I was right. You know, is like I just said, this is, you know, if the quality goes down, the audiences, they're not going to keep paying $7-$8 to see these movies when, you know, they see a few crappy ones, they're not going to go anymore. You know, and I guess everybody wanted me to just be this, you know, to, by this time that somebody had slapped me with this, you know, grandfather of Mormon cinema thing. And so I think they wanted me to just be this all supportive, paternalistic. And I wasn't, because I saw them pissing away what I had worked for almost a decade to put together, you know. So I felt it was necessary to get out there and say, this is what's happening, and we're killing this, and we can't, because, and I kept trying to push this idea of, we can be the source of spiritual cinema in the entire world. Nobody's interested in doing this. You know, we can pick up, these guys have been dead for, you know, 50 years. We can pick up where they left off, and we can really do something here. Nobody, you know, it was like I was talking to the wall, because and I kind of saw that when God's Army came out, and I started going around to campuses and speaking in groups, and I would say, you know, there's now a market for our films. We can finally tell our stories. And nobody heard the "we can tell our stories." It was, there's a market. And so you had all these people who
That's right.
were totally unprepared. You know, they didn't know their craft. They didn't, you know, they didn't care about cinema. It turns out they didn't care all that much about Mormonism. They were just jumping in and trying to capitalize on this market, and it absolutely killed it, you know. And so that's the sad. And so I made a lot of enemies by being upfront and saying, you know, everybody wanted me. And they kept. I stopped seeing the movies, actually, because people kept asking me,
"Have you seen it?
Have you seen it?"
And easier to not comment. I haven't seen it.
Exactly. Yeah. So after, you know, Handcart and Singles Ward and some of these others, and I finally just stopped seeing the movies, because it was easier just to say, "Oh, I haven't caught that one yet." Than to this day, I have not seen the Book of Mormon film. I haven't seen it, and don't really want to, you know, because I've heard enough about it that I know that it would just make me sad, and so I can't watch it. But those are the kind of films that I feel, you know, murdered my child. You know? This beautiful little baby that was going to be Mormon cinema, and you know, these sons of bitches just came along and strangled it. You know, and I do feel that strongly about it. Even though now, you know, my beliefs have changed, but this I still have a such an affection for and such a vision for it. It could still, you know, it can't anymore. It's dead, but it could have been something really beautiful, you know. So no, the whole Father of Mormon cinema thing. There's a few things I want to clear up. That was not something that was something that somebody slapped on me, and it's, you know, and it's kind of keeps being applied, and I don't mind. Like I say, at the beginning, I was very proud of it because I could see the potential. It was going to grow up into this beautiful, strong, you know, wonderful thing. But then it was just going to be this, you know, beautiful baby boy of mine. And then, but at some point, you know, I got hit on the head with a rock, and it started just to become this, you know, mentally handicapped. I'm great with metaphors, aren't I? But and so, I guess the movies themselves I'm very proud of, and the what it could have been I'm very proud of, and I'm very proud of the movement. I wish it had become even close to what it could have become. So I have very mixed feelings, and obviously I didn't think until you bring this up. I thought I had zenned away most of my anger on this, but yeah, it was hard to watch happen because, like I say, when you live with this, and it was such a strong vision and a purpose and a passion for so long to keep me going for so many years, and to finally see it realized and to get it started off in the right direction, and then to watch people just come in and piss on it was really, really difficult. And I would still love to see... well, here's what I learned. There is not going to be a Mormon cinema, and I should have known this when I just wasn't wise enough. I was too young and too naive at the time to realize it, but it's not going to happen. There's not going to be a great Mormon cinema movement. There's not going to be a great Mormon literature movement. There's not going to be a great Mormon anything, but there will be the occasional artist that will come along, and there will be, at some future point, there will be a great Mormon filmmaker. There will be a great Mormon writer. There's already a couple of them out there.
But mostly it'll be because of the tension with the community.
Yeah.
It'll be Asher Lev, the phenomenal artist,
right,
and the Hasidic community, and it's that tension that that creates so much.
And it's going to be an individual, you know, little explosion of brilliance. It's not going to be this cooperative effort, because that's just not going to happen.
Well, not every unequal talents, unequal will, unequal patience to get the right story.
Right.
So very interesting. Again, this may actually save us some time down the road, because I did have a whole section on Mormon cinema, but that I wanted to get with you on. But are you seeing some potential talents like this right now? Are there filmmakers out there? Or if you were to see somebody who is just, you know, a teenager who wants to be a spiritual filmmaker, you can put the Mormon part on that or not, what would you tell them to do?
What would I tell them to do?
Yeah, I mean...
Oh, I'd definitely encourage
them. Not try to start a movement, but you would tell them to do what?
No, I'd definitely tell them to encourage. I think the best stories we have to tell are these very spiritual stories. The most, you know, the most underexplored and underexpressed part of our human natures is our spiritual natures. So anybody that has an interest in exploring, you know, religion, spirituality from a serious... point of view is, I would absolutely encourage people to do that. My hopes for more, if there is something in the future for Mormon cinema, it's going to be, you know, somebody who was, you know, 8 years old, 10 years old when God's Army came out and kind of saw some of that. I'm still really I'm distressed when I meet so many people who, in the Mormon community, who have seen basically everything except my films. And I'm just kind of baffled. I'm just like, really? Wow. Okay. Okay. But my hopes are, if there's a hope for Mormon cinemas, that there was some kid, you know, that kind of got a glimpse of what I was going for and grows up and is not a part of the generation before me, and it's not a part of the generation, that God's Army period generation. Somebody is going to come along afterwards and have a new take on it, a new spin, you know, a new kind of a new story to tell. That's what I'd be so incredibly thrilled to see that. You know?
And then I'm wondering too, I mean, it was really fascinating for me to hear Gwen reading God's Army scripts, so there's not enough of you in it. You would probably encourage them just to, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm opening up the closet to some dark stuff in my family. I'm opening up the closet to XYZ. Isn't that every great artist has to be willing to say, the art has to come from my soul and from my own experience to some degree. Too.
No, so. Absolutely. In fact, that's something that's so important to me. And it's been something that's been difficult the past few years for me to struggle with is the fact that when I left Mormonism, which I felt I had to do for my own, you know, personal reasons and for my own integrity, it made it very difficult for me to continue telling, you know, personal stories, these kind of personal stories. So it's different, it's unique. It's like one of the main struggles I have right now is how to continue to do that, you know. And as the films, as continuing this talk on the subject of Mormon cinema, what I found is as my films got better, they made less money. And a lot of that had to do, I think, with the fact that, you know, I was trying to make them after the, you know, the tsunami of Mormon-themed garbage had come along. And so I was trying to get people to... that was a real struggle with States of Grace, is after I'd made it, by that time, I was coming in at the tail end of a lot of bad stuff, and so people were, you know, just totally uninterested in seeing another Mormon film, no matter how good it was. You couldn't convince them that it was good.
And yet you deliberately marketed it to not only the Mormon audience, but you were trying to go a crossover with Christian spiritual audience and stuff, too. You had characters in, you have characters in God's Army 2, States of Grace, that are definitely trying to appeal there. What was that your thinking? Is because I mean, did the story emerge on its own to have these other characters that were non-LDS for the most part, or was that as you created the script, you were already thinking crossover possibilities?
I don't think I was thinking crossover. I was just telling a story, and it just seemed like, I mean, it was in LA, and you know, it just kind of came about organically. But after it was there, then it was. Definitely is like, wow, this is a film that, you know, other people, other religions, other Christian religions could really embrace. But what I didn't understand at the time was the real depth of prejudice and bigotry against Mormonism, you know. So at the time, I was right in the middle. It's like by that time, the Mormons were tired of Mormon cinema, couldn't get them to go see my film. So I was reaching out, I was trying to compensate and trying to reach out and get the Baptists and Pentecostals and people to Methodists and Catholics to come see it because it was such
free screenings for ministers. Yeah. So
it was the craziest thing because we would get, you know, we would have to basically drag these people in, non-Mormons, in to see the film. Once they saw the film, it was, you know, mostly 90% of the reaction was completely positive. You know, people weeping and it's like, oh, it's a wonderful film. We've got to get other people to see it. But they could not get people to come see a movie about Mormon missionaries. And it just wasn't going to happen, you know? So,
then there's the experience in San Diego at the theater. Do you want to...
Experience in San Diego, there's a...
You're screening it, and it's kind of being marketed out there to the Christian community.
Right? It's just called States of Grace, and so it's out there, and it's... and, you know, we've gotten some great quotes from Christianity Today and people like that. That say that it's a great, or Seattle was it? We had a great one, but anyway, saying it was a milestone in Christian cinema, and so we were kind of pushing that. And then some people felt betrayed. You know, they came in, sat down, and the film started, and there was Mormon missionaries there, and so they got really angry, and you know, would go out and, you know, harangue the theater staff and saying, and then creating.
You need to warn everybody who's about to buy a ticket here that it's not what they expect.
It's not a Christian film. Yeah. It's a Mormon film, and And I kept, you know, you'd want to say just, well, if you'd sit your asses down and watch the film, by the end of it, you'd realize that it is a Christian film. And it's a Mormon film. But, yeah, there were protests, and it was just craziness. But it was it was really interesting by that time to, again, I felt like that was the best film I'd made to that point. And it was, I was trying to drag people, even Mormons, in to see this film. In fact, the best, when I really clued into how bad things had become was when I ran into Robert Kirby, who's a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. I ran into him at the Salt Lake Library, and he had loved my previous films. He'd written really highly about Brigham City and God's Army. Just a, you know, a big supporter, a big fan. And this was, you know, 3 or 4 weeks after States of Grace had come out, and it was already clear that it wasn't going to do very well. And so I asked him, he was like, hey, did you get around, did you go see States of Grace? And he's like, no, I didn't do it. And there was something in his voice that so I said, why didn't you go? And he stopped, and he was very honest, you know, and he just looked at me, and that's one thing I love about Robert Kirby, he's very honest. And he said, you know, it doesn't make any sense, because I've seen your other films, and I really like them, and I really like you, and yet I saw the poster for this, and I just thought, it's going to be another crappy Mormon film. Mm. And he goes, it doesn't make sense, but that's honestly what was in my head. It's another crappy Mormon film. And that's when I realized, when I had a guy who was one of my strongest supporters, who even he was so sick of Mormon cinema that he wouldn't see a film even if I had directed it. That's when I knew I was fighting a uphill battle and ultimately a losing battle.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even a ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.